Perfect.
Well, yeah, thanks for the chance to chat, and it's a hard act to follow, Elizabeth. I'm gonna switch topics a little bit, and then I'm gonna come back to some of the things that Elizabeth said right at the end here. We recently conducted an analysis of Kepler observations of Kepler-76b. This is a short period hot Jupiter, not quite ultra short, it's a day and a half orbital period, and looked for variations in its phase curve that might indicate meteorology on the planet. So I'm going to talk a little bit about this paper just came out. And I'm giving this, if you didn't notice, off my website. So if you see any links or videos or things you want to follow up on, just go to my website there. You can see it. So I was interested in the first space observations of weather when I started this project. And this is the first weather satellite picture ever taken in 1960 by the TIROS spacecraft. TIROS is Television and Infrared Observing Satellite. It didn't have infrared capability, so I'm not quite sure why it had infrared in the name. But this is it. This is the first weather satellite picture. It's pretty neat.
So infrared can also mean basically beyond the visual range. It's kind of
yeah. The article I found about this said specifically that it didn't have infrared capabilities. So I don't know. Yeah, I don't know exactly if it meant that.
It's not GHK what we think of as infrared.
I don't know what they intended when they named it infrared, but the article said it didn't have infrared capabilities. Of course, for exoplanets, we don't have that kind of resolution, so usually what we're doing is looking at, say, a transiting exoplanet and observing the amount of light coming from the system. I don't need to explain this to folks in this room. So what we're looking for is the up and down associated with the rotation into view of the planet's day side. We're thinking here of very short period objects, and so they're probably tidally locked. And so just as the planet is going into eclipse, secondary eclipse on the other side of the orbit, that's when the day side rotates into view. This has, of course, been done for a number of planets. It's very famous. This is the HD 189733b Spitzer observations from Heather Knudsen, and it's this lovely up and down from the phase curve of the planet, and then there's this dip. That's the eclipse. You can estimate, using the depth of the eclipse and the wavelengths, what the brightness temperature of the planet is, and then I don't remember what 1973 and 1212 is meant to be. I don't remember. Oh, actually, this is the brightness temperature of the night side of the planet. And then they have this really lovely orange peel map. You can convert that phase curve into a map that looks like this. And what you see, and what you can see in the phase curve as well, is that the brightest point on the day side of the planet is offset from the substellar point by about 16 hours. And so that was it's pretty neat, but it is consistent with expectations before these observations were made. The day-night contrast, as you can see here on this planet, is hundreds of degrees Kelvin, and that large contrast sets up this super rotating jet on these hot Jupiters, and so you get this enormous jet near the equator blowing hot air from the substellar point downwind, and so that offset is indicative of meteorology in the planet. In the planet's atmosphere.
Do we know anything about the rotation axis of the planet? Prograde, retrograde? Naively, you would say prograde, but
I'm trying to think of. There have been some constraints on these things. There was a paper, actually, I think just on archive this morning, that argues that you might be able to use the phase curves to look for signs of obliquities, indications of the obliquity here. But this is assuming tidal locking. This paper assumed it was tidally locked. They probably are tidally locked, but you can get some interesting rotation states for these systems. So it could be more complicated. I'm not going to address any of that here, though. That's a really good question. And so we actually have a handful of observations like this now, where we can actually estimate the phase curve offset in degrees and the geometric albedo for these planets as a function of their effective temperatures. And there's some very interesting trends you can see here. For instance, the coolest, and when I say coolest, I'm talking about 1800 Kelvin, the coolest planets here have offsets to the west. So a negative value here represents a westward offset. So the brightest point on the day side is actually upwind from the substellar point. Whereas the hottest objects, now we're talking about 2200 Kelvin, they have offsets to the east, downwind of the substellar point. So that's really interesting. Oh, and I was just going to remind everyone, geometric albedo here is this. This is the geometric albedo over 4. There's the planet's radius, and there's the orbital distance. Just, I had to remind myself the difference between the different albedos. So geometric albedo is that. The Kepler spacecraft, in spite of the fact that it's observing primarily invisible wavelengths, is actually sensitive to thermal emission from some of these really hot Jupiters. You're probably familiar with this, but here's the Kepler bandpass, and then the dashed orange line is the blackbody curve for 2000 Kelvin blackbody. So you get a substantial amount of thermal emission. So for these ultra-short, for these hot Jupiters, we're seeing not just potentially reflection from the atmospheres, but also thermal emission. And then you get these just beautiful results. This is from Parmentier, 2016. What he's done here is modeled the brightness, the flux observed by Kepler in the atmospheres of these planets for a different, a variety of different effective temperatures. So along the top there, you can see the brightness temperature for the day side in Kelvin. This is what the atmosphere would look like to Kepler if the planet had no clouds at all, and so the coolest objects, of course, they're not emitting invisible, so you don't see them really. But when you start to get to things like Kepler 76 and HAT P7, you actually see a fair amount of emission. And here you can see when it's cloudless, most of that emission is coming from the eastern hemisphere. So this is all stuff that's being blown downwind from the substellar point. When you start thinking about clouds, though, these cool planets, they can have a lot of clouds on their day side. And depending on the cloud species here, you can get different sort of day sides. And then when you start to get to the hotter and hotter objects, the day sides are actually hot enough that these aerosols evaporate very quickly. And so even though you have some amount of day-night transport blowing these aerosols around from the night side, eventually you get so hot that there's only just kind of this limb where you can see clouds, and then everything is evaporated before you can see it. And then Parmentier even argued that you can use the phase curve to determine the compositions of the clouds, because the more refractory the species, the more of this you're going to see on the day side. And so the phase curves that we see from some of these hot planets is a combination of reflected light, which is going to give you a phase offset in the to the west. No, he's got a plus here. So you're going to get reflected light that peaks over here and emitted light that peaks over here. And so the shape of the phase curve, where the peak occurs, is telling you the balance between these two components. So when you've got a lot of offset to the east of the substellar point, that's primarily thermal emission. And when you've got a lot of offset to the west, that's probably reflected light.
Let's assume an eject in the atmosphere.
Yes, and so you expect that these jets are a pretty robust feature of the atmosphere. We have a reasonably rich understanding of the meteorology.
It's from the model only.
So, I'm sorry?
It's only from the model, yeah? There is no detection of a jet.
We don't have weather probes to these atmospheres. Yeah, all we have are the phase curves. But the results are consistent with what you expect for a jet.
Let's get this idea that in highly magnetized atmospheres, you can get a reversal.
Oh, yeah, so this is really good. And I'll come back to that, actually. Yeah, so many of these planets probably have substantial magnetic fields, in fact. And the presence of a magnetic field, the gas in these atmospheres is hot enough that some of it's ionized. And so you can actually get ohmic drag in the atmospheres. And in fact, I meant to say this, but the phase curve is offset to the east less than you would expect if there were not drag in the atmosphere. So there's some amount of ohmic drag in these atmospheres, which actually makes this phase curve offset smaller than you would expect. And so in principle, the phase curve offset is also giving you a sense for the strength of the magnetic field. These atmospheres, of course, are not static. Let me see if I can play this. They can vary substantially. This is just a video of, this is HD 80606, right? 80606b, just showing what happens when this planet in this highly eccentric orbit sweeps past the star and pericenter. And you can just see that the atmosphere is just really dynamic. Just to make the point that these planets can have substantially dynamic atmospheres. And then this is a plot making that point again. This is showing, if you just focus here on the substellar point, this is showing the abundance of a tracer aerosol species at the substellar point as a function of different aerosol radii. So really teeny aerosols, big aerosols. And the bigger the aerosol, the more variability in the amount of aerosol on the day side you get over time. So this is for a system where the object is not in an eccentric orbit. This is just dynamical variability in the atmosphere. So that tells us that these atmospheres are pretty variable. We would expect that their phase curve should be varying, potentially from orbit to orbit. And so we looked at one system, Kepler-76, where we expected to maybe see some of this variability. This is the transit. I can't see my notes here, but it's a hot Jupiter, sort of a stereotypical hot Jupiter. Here is the phase curve and eclipse. So here's the eclipse right here. And then we have a kind of an up and down that you get. This system is actually, the star is actually bright enough, the planet's massive enough and close enough to its star that we actually see not just the phase curve from the planet, but the beaming effect, so the radial velocity of the star. And we also see ellipsoidal variation, so we can actually see the tidal distortion on the star from the planet. So we fit all of that into this model. And so for our analysis, what we did was to look. This is all the data we have for Kepler-76, but we broke it up kind of orbit by orbit, fit phase curve parameters to each of those sets of orbits, and then determine the phase curve amplitude and offset as a function of time. And that's what you see here. So this is the eclipse. So we, of course, also fit the eclipse depth as a function of time, but the eclipse here, each orbit is only like 1 or 2 points, because remember, this is a 1.5-day orbital period, and so the transit's like an hour. And
so, typical error bars.
What are the typical error bars? The per-point error bars is about 200 parts per million. Is that consistent with what we're seeing here? 100 parts per million?
Your scatter is much less than that.
From here to here? Okay, 50. Yeah, this is a really bright system, so we have pretty good error bar. We have pretty small uncertainties compared to other systems. So the eclipse depth is really short here. And so although we do see, and so this is a plot now I'm showing of the eclipse depth in parts per million as a function of time. The other benefit of this system is we have, you know, almost 1,000 days of observation. So we got a lot of data to average up over. Each of the different colored points represents binning over different numbers of orbits. So 10, 20, and 40 orbits, I think, is what we did. Averaging up over orbits, of course, has the benefit that you increase your signal to noise, but it also means that you're averaging out any variability. So you're trying to thread this needle, try a couple of different things.
Is there activity there?
This is an F star, so we don't see any obvious activity, but we tried to look for that as well. So we looked at variations in the transit depths and see if there's any correlation with these variations. We didn't see any variation in the transit depth, so I don't think this is variability.
But is the overall envelope of variability in the depth similar for the eclipses and the transits? Like, is the little bit that you see in the green there, is that systematic because you see a similar level in the transits, or is this a real?
I don't see any significant variations in the transits. And when you plot eclipse depth versus transit depth, orbit to orbit, you don't see a correlation there.
Okay.
So if the star is doing something really sadistic and varying just at each eclipse, then it could form.
I was more thinking like the space, like the, you know, with the observation, some spacecraft or systematics, but that would also.
I would have guessed. Yeah, that's what we guessed, was that we would see that effect in the transits, and we didn't see that. Okay. All right. But all that said, the variations here that I'm showing for the eclipse depth are all more or less than 3 sigma variations. And so although they're not zero, I'm not sure that I believe these. However, and the reason that we don't get a good fix on these variability in the eclipse is because the eclipses are so short. So we only have 2 data points each orbit. So you're not getting a really strong signal here. But for the phase curve, of course, that spans the whole orbit, almost the whole orbit. And so you get really good fits on the phase curve amplitude. And here I'm showing what is equivalent to the amplitude. And you see lots of up and down. And here we do see greater than 3 sigma variations. We did some statistical tests on these and convinced ourselves that these are not just random noise. We're actually seeing something that's distinct from random noise. So the variations here are real, I think.
How do you fit out, I think about my question carefully, how do you fit out stellar variability? How do you separate that from the planet's phase?
So we don't, again, I didn't see anything in the data that looked like phase curve, that stellar variability. This is an F star. On top of which, if you make a plot of amplitude variations versus transit depth, you don't see a correlation. And I would expect that stellar variability would make those both vary in concert. So if the star were varying in such a way to give us variations in the phase curve, I'd expect that the transit would also vary sometimes, too. And so I'd expect to see a robust positive correlation.
That would depend on the transit. I guess either covering the spot or the star being so spotted during sometimes but not others, that you get a wrong transit depth just from the star changing so much.
You would get a wrong transit depth that's just bulleted in any case, as long as your transit port is different from the rest of the star.
But this will be unlikely for like an early-ish or whatever F star.
This is a 1600 Kelvin
one could just
star.
One step to check if there's any activity. It would surprise me, actually.
You don't see rotational modulation in the data themselves. On top of which, like I said, I would have expected to see a correlation between the phase curve amplitude and the transit depth if the star were varying, right? If the star swap rotated into view, that would make the transit what look
Well, it depends if you go
deeper.
Over the spot or if you are going where the spot is not, right? Because
sure.
It's the direction for the transit
depth. Yes, but in any case, it would change the transit depth, right? And I would expect it to also change the phase curve amplitude.
Well, do you know the rotation period of the star?
I don't.
I mean, because that would be one way to sort of rule that out.
So it would have to be comparable to the orbital period of the planet, right? In order to be
like
important.
It would be particularly cruel.
That's what I mean. That it would have to be a
we
statistic
see this,
system.
Right? We have lots of cases where these close and these close and planets where there's near co-rotation.
What'd you say the period of this one was?
1.5 days.
That would be that's unusual good. For an F star.
That's normal for an F star.
For early, yeah. So the thing to do would be measure B sine I, use a Geier parallax.
This, I think, is known. I should check this.
And then make an estimate of it.
I don't think.
Independent of it.
Yeah, I think in my speaker notes, I actually have the V sine I written down for this system. Let's see.
You can get R star from Berger et al. And if you have B sine I, assuming that it's
actually, huh? Thought I could see my speaker.
Luckily, it's not too big.
Ah, here we go. Did I have B sine I written down? I did not have B sine I written down. Okay, but this is a pretty well characterized system, so.
And it's bright. Right?
Probably is known.
So you can get one. KP of 13.
Good. Good. We could. Publish a correction, or this is already published. So again, I guess I would expect it would have to be a really sadistic system to like make the phase curve vary in such a way that you didn't also see variations in the transit at the same time, right? Because everything you're describing, I think, would give us variations in both. And unless there's like a spot directly antipodal to the planet, so we don't see in transit, but we do see it in phase curve. In the phase curve, right? It would have to be a pretty sadistic system.
So it's offset by 180, is that what you're saying?
I'm trying to think of ways that a star spot could make us think that the phase curve for the planet was varying in amplitude, but not the transit. Because that's what we're worried about, right? Is that this could be stellar variability, and I'm telling you that we fit the transit point to point as well. We do not see a correlation in the phase curve amplitude and the transit depth.
I will tell you, we see many stars where we see rotational variability.
Yes.
Forget about the planets. Let's do it. And we see no variation in the transit depth. Right. So you cannot necessarily relate transit depth to show that there is an absence of stellar variability.
So what is the... Okay, so you see rotational modulation in the star, but no changes in the transit depth.
That's right.
How does that work?
Because of the distribution, Laura was sort of mentioning this, because it depends on the distribution of spots. And you have to have sort of, this only happens where you have cases where you have these anomalous sort of clustering of spots, if you would expect this to happen. In other words, there's a lot of parameter space where the correlation between the transit depth and the rotational variability is broken. Because of the distribution of spots.
Right. But you do see rotational modulation in these cases.
Yes, yeah,
we
absolutely.
Don't see rotational modulation for this star.
Well, I guess the question is, okay.
So it has to be a star that's spotted in such a way that gives no rotational modulation, and also doesn't cause the transit to change, but does cause the phase curve to change amplitude. And I'm sure nature is cruel.
You test this with other Kepler light curves where there isn't, say, a planet at 1.5 days. Other F-type stars with light curves from Kepler that have similar V sine I, and just ask the same question, like over this period of time, do you see similar, or over these different time scales, do you see similar variability in the light curve? Because the variability doesn't even have to come from the dominant stellar rotation mode. It could just be some sort of weird granulation bubbling or something happening in the star. There's so many things stars do at so many different timescales. So the, really, I think the way to test this would be to show that you don't get this kind of variability when there is no planet at that period.
So I will say that we did an injection recovery test for these things. So we took this sequence of variations, shifted it around, and injected it back into the data, and were able to recover these.
So so you've demonstrated that you've found variability, but that doesn't attribute it to being to the planet rather than the star.
But what I mean is if we take these variations and put them so that they would be out of sync with any stellar variability, we get back the same variations. What I'm saying is we take our phase curve model and make the phase curve amplitude do this up and down, but shift it by half the observational baseline. So in principle, it would be shifted out of phase with the stellar variability if there is any. And we're able to recover these amplitude variations.
But that might be the stellar variability.
That might be the stellar variability.
Well, that might be only it, right? Otherwise, you wouldn't see any secondary eclipses. So it must be at least some phase variability from the planet.
The secondary eclipse depth can only be the planet. Yeah. Changes in the secondary eclipse depth cannot be.
Well, and so, like, again, I'll make sure that I'm clear that we do see what looks like variations in the eclipse depth, but they're not statistically robust, so I wouldn't necessarily claim these to be.
Right, but if they're consistent with the variability you see...
They are. I mean, you can draw a straight line through what you would expect the amplitude of the phase curve to be and what the eclipse depth is, and they do correlate positively.
I mean, that's a pretty strong sign to me.
That's true. Yeah.
But, like I said, these are just not three sigma variations, because the uncertainties are quite large. I wish you guys were the referee of this paper. I should have brought the paper.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
What is it?
5 kilometers per second? Okay, so it's pretty slow.
Does that relieve everyone's concern?
It's a slow one.
But I like the idea of comparison to the sample of F stars in general.
So I will say that the same kind of variations we're seeing for HAT-P7. I'm not talking about that here, but HAT-P7 showed similar variations.
Yeah, I don't believe the weather thing about HAT-P7 either. for a similar reason, right? Like, you've got to, you know, if it really is the planet, you should be able to look at a bunch of stars that don't necessarily have a planet at that exact same period, and then find that some of the variability in your star with the planet can't be explained based on stellar variability from all the other stars.
Well, okay. I think the secondary eclipse thing is critical. If you have a plot that shows somehow...
I don't have it here, but I do. But you do. I did do that, make that plot, but then I got less excited about it when I noticed that these weren't three sigma variations. So, but there is a positive correlation between
the...
I don't have it on this. Yeah, I can show it though. Yeah.
Of course, if we had two pass bands, then a lot of this could be addressed. So you
wouldn't. Maybe they should launch another
Kepler. Should launch another Kepler.
We have tests. It's
not quite the same, but the pass bands are actually displayed.
Well, I don't want to keep people from lunch. This is just showing a positive correlation between the phase offset delta and the amplitude. So when the planet gets brighter, the phase curve gets offset to the west, and so that's kind of consistent with what you expect. Clouds are rotating in and out of view over meteorological timescales. That's that. Tests, yeah, I think tests will have some leverage on this. Of course, test baselines aren't going to be as long, so you don't have 1,000 days of observation. This is not assuming anything about the continuous viewing zone, yeah. So what I'm showing here is the log of the signal-to noise ratio along the y-axis in the left plot versus orbital period. And these are the hypothetical systems from Barclay's paper, just showing that you get a lot of emitted light for these eclipses as opposed to reflected light, which is what you're mostly seeing with Kepler. So I thought it was pretty neat. Phase curves might be useful for distinguishing false positives from real planets because stars are self-luminous but planets are not, and so you can put some constraints on the depth or the size of the phase curve variability you expect for a real planetary system. And so we're sort of developing this heuristic test where you can take something that might be a planet in the test data, see if it has a phase curve variability that's consistent with the planet, and if it doesn't, then you can say it's probably not a planet, or at least it's not clear that it's a planet. If it does, and you say maybe it is a planet, then you send some follow-up after it. So, This is just showing that that is true for WASP-18, which was observed by TESS. These are TESS data.
Can you explain what's going on?
Yeah, so this so WASP-18 is another one of these systems that exhibits ellipsoidal variations. And so this up and down is some of that's the phase curve, some of that's the ellipsoidal variation.
Do you have one of the ones where it doesn't agree?
Yep. Mm-hmm. Oops. Yeah, so this shows a case where the transit, which is off the page here, looks maybe planet-like, but when you actually go in and see what the phase curve modulations look like, they're inconsistent with a planet. We know this is not a planet, so that's helpful.
So why is it not a planet? Can you explain?
Why is it not? Because it's a star.
the phase curve
variability that you expect here, if it were a planet, based on the orbital period and the size of the object, is shown in the dashed green line. And then the actual model fit is the orange line, and those are inconsistent.
I don't see that. I think it's fine. The depth, you can argue about the depth, but I think the shape is fine.
Sure. This one's fine.
No, I don't think so. No, because look at the green line here. It's way over here, way above that. The point is not that the green line passes through many of the error bars. The point is that it passes well beyond. When you compare like the mismatch between the two things, it's, several sigma different or something, right? It's not.
So when you break down your green model into the Doppler beaming component and the ellipsoidal variation component and the reflection component, is there one component in particular where the planetary hypothesis is like driving the green line to be where it is?
Yes. In this case, the beaming effect peaks after the eclipse.
Yeah.
Which is the opposite of what you expect for a planetary system.
Right. So you basically get a mess out of your beaming effect.
You could, in principle. The problem here, of course, is that you may have blending. This is the whole point of this approach, is to try to distinguish between blended things and non-blended things. And so, in this case, it's not necessarily the amplitude that's important. It's the phase of the beaming effect, which is important.
Okay.
So the amplitude that's why it peaks after the eclipse, and that's consistent with what you expect for a planet. Yeah.
Is this published or?
It is published in a proposal.
I'd like to model this.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be great. Yeah, sure. We can we share a proposal? Is that a thing you can do?
If you send me the data, I don't need.
Oh, the data we can send. That's well, these are online. These are just test data. What's that?
It's my proposal. Yes.
If you send me the data, I'd like to model them.
Sure.
I mean, yeah, we actually kind of wanted to publish a paper based on the.
This is one of our projects we're going to
talk about modeling light curves from planets, reflected light curves, and I have the code to model that, basically.
Yeah, so we think this is one way you can maybe distinguish. But of course, it's only useful when the planet is really close to the star and really hot, and that's what we're interested in, is ultra-short planets. So this won't be useful for longer period things, but for short period things, I think it could be. Short period big things. Cool.
Another question. This is short period, yeah? So it's probably rocky planet.
No, this one's a big one. This is a hot Jupiter.
I don't remember the period of this thing.
I don't remember the period.
The transit depth is consistent with being a hot Jupiter.
Okay. This particular one is probably an eclipsing binary. Some of these ones we have to extract.
Phase curve modulations are inconsistent. Yeah. So this, what we're trying to do is save ourselves, a little bit of work. Like we'll do our transit search, look for things that look like planets, and then apply this phase curve analysis to see, okay, is it consistent with being a hot Jupiter?
It can't be rocky because it has a secondary.
It has a very deep secondary eclipse here, so it has to be something big.
But it's still very interesting, even if it's star, it's very interesting data.
Oh yeah, I don't mean to disparage stars. I'm sure yes, there are very interesting things there too. But yeah, we're looking for planets. So, right, I'm happy to continue taking questions, but I don't want to keep people from lunch. So, thanks very much.
Yeah, thanks.